Work is kind of like just starting still after a few months, but I want
Okay,
to.
okay.
Also, someone named Daniel is waiting. If I don't know if I couldn't let him because I'm a visitor, so like
Daniel, who?
top one, I'm not sure.
Oh,
He
okay.
said
So
it
it's from
first.
the Boston University.
Oh,
Yeah.
okay. He's gonna put himself on the list.
Yeah.
All right, yep, wait.
I'll go get him.
Okay. Okay. Okay, so first, you minimize this. Thank you. Okay, so this is the thing that I'm working on right now. But to introduce the task, let me ask you guys this question. So you see here two person. One is Marilyn Monroe, one is Isaac Newton. Can you find a specific connection between them? The only constraint is that the connection cannot be something super trivial, like these are both names of famous people.
Can I say something?
How are we defining trivial? I feel like there's like a gradient there.
That is true, but something super specific. Let's say their nationality, they like some common attributes that they share. It can be their profession or anything, something specific. It's not super obvious, right? Because these are two very different people. So, but if you ask a language model, specifically Qwant72b, it'll say that they are both associated with Apple. Okay, they're both associated with Apple. How is that? Well, it seems like in 1950s, Marilyn Monroe had this iconic photograph with an apple, and also we know the famous falling apple that inspired Isaac Newton to invent gravity or discover gravity. So okay, so this is way beyond some simple fact retrieval. This is something like the model needs to do some deliberate reasoning with different pieces of information to actually perform some kind of task. And we want to know how the model does this kind of system to reasoning. And also, there is some link with creativity, at least with combinatorial creativity, because that also involves like combining multiple different things to basically create something, create a combination that is novel and also meaningful and valuable in some way. So, okay, we want to know if the model can do that and how the model does that. So, okay, we think we have a pretty good or a pretty faithful abstract model of how the language model retrieves atomic facts. By atomic facts, we mean some facts like Eiffel Tower is in Paris. So, as the first part, the subject entity goes through this enrichment process by earlier MLPs, and after that, the latent, you can think of the enriched latent containing all these informations. Like for Marilyn Monroe, the enriched latent will have these associations like actress, blonde, apple-themed photo shoot, blah, blah, blah. For Isaac Newton, it will have physicist, gravity, calculus, these kind of things. And how the language model solves this task? Well, these are all our hypotheses. We have not really tested them, but yet. But our first hypothesis is that, well, the model, after doing this individual enrichment, it takes this set intersection operation. Well, they both also had a pet dog. Okay. So these are not simply like these are not really conflicting hypotheses. Probably H3, I graded out probably a little bit too much. Probably H3 is how H1 gets implemented. H2 is something which is also possible, but maybe it's not super generalizable. But yeah, anyways, we have different hypotheses, and this is the experiment setup we have been working on. We create a fake universe of people, like a bunch of synthetic people that the model has no idea who they are. And we inject this information with fine-tuning while making sure that that question that we are asking, well, a valid criticism will be that maybe some documents since these models are trained with internet scale data, maybe some documents contain some information about Marilyn Monroe and Isaac Newton together, and the model is just copying that information from the training data. So while we fine-tune it, we make sure that the model does not see both of these people in the same document that we are asking about. And yeah, once we inject this information, we evaluate if the model can make these connections, and then we want to know actually do the interpretability experiments to understand how the model does this experiment, how the model makes this connection. That's it. That's all I had.
So,
Yeah.
any findings so far you can share?
So we are still doing experiments to have a little bit more control over our experiment setup. So the one thing that we are a little bit stuck on is that only the huge, very large models can do this, like the 70 billion parameter scale models. And we did have a fine-tuning setup where we are only
Can do what
fine-tuning
you mean? To do the by association.
the Bayes association, yes. And we do have a setup where we are injecting, where we are fine-tuning only the first 30 MLPs of Llama, with this fake first data set. It does way above random baseline, of course, but it is still something not we are satisfied about.
How good is it?
How good is it?
So, okay, so what your research program is, or what's your research plan? So you have this,
What is my research plan?
share with everybody, and I'd love to discuss this with everybody.
Sure. So we are looking for this kind of set intersection operation with language models, right? If the language models can do it. So the research plan is to so this is basically the experiment setup we are playing with right now, right? So
So E parentheses is the embedding of. Is that an embedding? What is the enriched?
enriched latent.
Oh, enriched latent. Okay, so does that mean like the latent, like halfway
After
through or something?
halfway through. So currently my immediate plan is to get as much control over over the first two steps, basically. To really understand if the capability is actually in there, can the model actually do these connections or Bayes associations task? Well, it's okay if it is a little bit inconsistent, but as long as it is way above random baseline, just so that we can convince ourselves that the capability is in there.
So how often can it do it right now?
I shared some updates on the Discord, but I have not been. Where's my
Yeah,
Discord?
you can share them with the whole
Yeah,
team.
sure.
Yes.
Here's my channel. Okay. These values are too small. So how do you read these results? So basically, right now we are only interested in three attributes: nationality, profession, and school, whether these two people graduated from the same university. And how you treat this result is that you treat this result as the top K accuracy. Basically, this result means that if these two people share the same nationality, the correct nationality appears in the top 1, 2, 3, 4 predictions 86% of the times.
So you ask, what does John Doe have in common with Mary Schmoke, right? And then the model says, what does this model say? How does the model answer?
The model is supposed to say something like this. Yes, nationality. They're both American, or they're both German, or something
Oh,
like
and do
that.
you get that format through ICL or?
I do not provide ICL, but I provide this format, like this person A and person B, these are just, they're just placeholders.
Oh, I see. So it's sort of ICL.
It's,
Sort, yeah, it's like this format.
instruction,
A format instruction.
And also, sometimes, nationality is easy to guess based on the names, but Well, for profession and school, it is very hard to make a
Maybe
connection.
based on the names.
Both of these names sound Mexican or Spanish, things
Oh,
like that.
so you do that. You don't just randomly assign a nationality. You pick a name that matches the nationality.
When I create this, so all of these synthetic entities, attributes of these synthetic entities, they are also created using Claude. It has a strong reference.
Oh, so you create, so you don't tell Claude John Doe is from Mexico. You tell Claude, come up with the whole person. Is that right? Oh.
But you could just shuffle the
You could shuffle that.
we could do that, but it's also something unnatural though, right?
Oh no. Could somebody else get us?
I can go, guys. Who's the person?
Young, so he's standing.
Yeah, nobody's using the form.
Sorry, one sec.
Yeah.
I have a question. Can I ask?
Um,
Hi.
yeah, I don't know. I wonder what people think.
When you ask a question,
Yeah.
do you know if there is only one attribute that they share out of those three, or?
So right now it is either one or none.
Okay.
So right now we make sure that yeah, there is only a single connection, but it can be eventually multiple, of course.
And this is after you fine-tune the model, right?
Oh no, this is after we fine-tune the model.
Oh, okay. All the ones
And
were before.
yeah, the you can
And with random.
you can treat the before as the kind of like the low baseline or the
Yeah.
random baseline. Yeah, just guessing. Yes.
I see. Yeah, so the name is a giveaway. So we definitely need to shuffle the names so that the baseline is exactly
Or
right. I don't think that like we're not interested in
yeah. Or maybe don't even
that.
care about nationality.
Or maybe take nationality
Yeah.
out of the equation. Yeah. Interesting.
But I mean, I guess shuffling is the best control, right? Because if you just say we don't care about nationality, but still the model is the one that generated all these personas, then probably school is also a tattoo.
Yes. Yeah. The thing is that do we really want to introduce
Tattoos.
some weird cases so that the model's prior belief get engineered? Like maybe someone with a Scottish name should not be from Mexico? I don't know.
Well, I don't know. I'm not sure. So like I feel like so are you trying to make the task harder or easier?
Right now easier, of course, because yeah.
I see, interesting. But it seems like it's make you're making it easier for the wrong reason. Like you're going after. It seems like you should be going after, this associational memory
Oh yeah.
rather than a built-in bias. So I'd like to show
Yeah.
this.
We are definitely not interested in the built-in bias. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. And so it seems like it might be harder to learn about the memory if you have more cases
I'd
to
suggest just
solve for the
getting,
bias. Yeah.
if the nationality is sort of problematic, just getting rid of it.
I know, but you might have a
Yeah.
bias for professions and so on, right? Like, oh, it's a
Profession.
female name. Oh, maybe more likely to be a certain profession. It's a male name, more likely to be a certain profession, that kind of thing, right? So you've got if you
Yeah, like
let,
American names
yeah.
yeah,
being more in American
Yeah. So
universities.
you'll
So
always have this issue. Maybe like.
one setup we are considering is to just. So bias comes with people, right? Just don't care about people. Just introduce a bunch of new animals. So now you don't have bias. Maybe.
I think you're always gonna have
Yeah,
it.
you
You just
should.
have to control for
Yeah.
it because maybe it's just that you know less about animals, and so you would think that there's no bias, but there might
Yeah.
be.
Yeah, probably.
Yeah, I feel like the only thing you need the other language model for is to create like fluent biographies. It's not you don't need the other language model to, bias all your data. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Yeah.
But we don't you also want the profiles to be somewhat consistent with the pre-trained language models, kind of like knowledge base?
Generating all of them from like the exact same demographic.
That's also possible. Yeah. Then whatever the bi oh well,
I think the shuffling is always like the cleanest. So it's like if you want to like if somebody if like a doctor is trying to do like a randomized control medical trial, they don't say, oh, maybe we won't randomize the people. Maybe we'll just like take the people as they are and then but carefully choose the demographic or whatever, right? No, it's just randomized. They're gonna have a randomized double blind placebo, for half the people in trial, right? They just randomness is the standard solution, right?
Like
But
for
it's
sure the
nice to
model
have.
uses these biases to like be better at predicting knowledge,
Of course, yeah.
but at the same time it does know stuff that are like out of distribution. Like there are people that have names from other countries that study somewhere else and live somewhere else. And if they're like famous enough that they appear enough, like the model knows that. So if you're really able to teach it, then it's good.
So on the formal causal, inference theory is like, okay, in the real world, you have underlying cultural causes causing some sort of relations that causes some language to show up, right? And like, and then when you're looking at like, and then language causes the model, the AI, to come up with some inferences or something like this, right? And so we're going back, and what you're hoping is to find out like how these things are connected. But because you've got this other arrow back here, right? You might find, oh, actually the model's actually thinking about, the causes all the way back here, right? And so the standard thing you do in causal inference is you say, oh, actually, if we're not interested in an arrow, then we break it. And the way you break things is you introduce like phase roles in the thing that you want to break, right? And so I think that, so this is just like, does that make sense? Yeah, so I think that it's as simple as that, right? It's just like, oh, you actually need to cut this edge, right? And the standard way of cutting the edge is just to introduce dash rules, right? That makes sense, right? So I don't know, if you kind of think of it mathematically, right, then it becomes like, all becomes clear, right? We just have to cut the edge, right?
Sorry, just to keep track of time,
Okay, we
just
gotta
really
talk about Ersa, but I think this is already like good. But like another general question is, so you're sitting here at 40%, 30%, right? Which is not bad. So like, how many people do you have in your data set?
72.
72. So
That
what's 30% of 72?
oh no, this is not 72 connections though, because you need two people to make a connection. So basically it's 36 data points.
So it's 12.
It's 40% of 16,
Yeah.
17.
Okay. So is 12 enough to run experiments on the 12 that work?
Maybe I'd
I
probably,
also suggested you said like maybe chatting with like one new person in an existing entity, because then you're still controlling that the model has not seen these two together, and then maybe it's easier because the model knows a lot about the other entity, and then you get like more examples.
But maybe
That's
12
good.
is enough.
Yeah, that's true.
Maybe, like, what do you think of just 12? So like I'm a little bit of a, so anyway, sorry, I'm sort of dominating the brainstorming here. But I kind of feel like yeah, instead of being discouraged by like it's only 30% or something like that, maybe the thing to do is to make a sprint all the way to the end of the experiment, right? To see if there's anything, right, with the 12 people that, or the 12 relations that work, right? And then if you like get some positive signal, I think that'll be kind of energizing, right? If you don't get a positive signal, then, well, maybe you weren't surprised because you're skeptical about your 12 anyway, but you might get some hints in what other success and failure cases or what it looks like, right? Or right, some of your dilemmas on how you're arranging your data set and your training, right? I feel like it'll make you less blind, right?
I also feel like we can have more control over this setup. So right now, how you're tuning these models is a little bit wacky. because of resource constraints, of course.
I see, I
I
see.
mean, we were tuning only first 30 MLPs with this weird normal regularization restrictions and everything. We should probably get rid of them. And yes, I'll start another training run while doing these experiments.
Anyway, I'm gonna let Eric talk about his thing. Totally dominated the discussion, but everybody should like chat with Arnold about his thing. And maybe I should shut up more so you guys can give feedback. All right. So I've been working on this, we're calling it the
We can't hear you.
Okay. I'm sad that our this audio
Yeah.
doesn't work.
Yeah, you should
Thanks.
work.
Thanks.
It was so wonderful. Maybe I find it at least message.
It doesn't work. Okay, I'll start over. Now can you hear me? Okay. I've been studying this in context algebra setting. So we trained some small transformers on these in context algebra tasks, where the symbols or the tokens that we're using, they don't actually mean anything themselves. They only have meaning based on their context.
Okay, so Eric has presented this like a couple months ago. Who's familiar with what the algebra task is? If you raise your hand if you're familiar with like his setting. And okay, actually, who's not familiar with the algebra task? Oh, that's like more than half. Oh no. Okay, you need to like, maybe give a little bit more background.
Okay, sure. So you can think about this like modular arithmetic, maybe. Where like addition governs how you take two elements and you add them and you mod some number, right? So in this case, like this would be mod five, like integers mod five. So there's really only five elements, like 0 through 4, and algebra basically dictates like how the elements interact with each other.
So, like your first
So for
example is.
example, so like 3 plus 2 maps to 0 because like 3 plus 2 is 5, but since we're mod 5, it mods back to 0. Does that make sense? So we've trained these transformers on basically you sample some vocabulary assignment to elements in a group. That gets changed for every sequence. And then you show in context a bunch of few shot examples to the model. So like something like this, like 3 plus 2 is 0, 0 plus 1 is 1. And it's supposed to infer at the final pair query what 3 plus 1 is based on what 3 and 1 are defined from previous shots in the context.
So the context never had 3 plus 1 before.
Right.
But it has to guess it anyway.
Yeah, any questions about that?
You said you're using small transformers that you train them.
Yeah, so pre-trained from scratch on just stuff like this.
And could they do have like some background on the symbol or
Nope.
the like
It's like the vocab size is like 16, so. And we pre-train them from scratch, so there's no underlying training. Or what do you mean?
Okay. No, I understand. You answered my question anyway, since but they would throughout this training understand these symbols in this context.
Or this task, they understand the external task.
Oh.
But understanding the symbols is weird because explain the second line. The second line is
Ah,
what you're doing. Yeah.
so this second line is the same as the first line, just all the symbols have been reassigned. So all the elements have been reassigned to new symbols. So like so now six is the identity element. So like instead of 0 plus 1 being 1, you have like 6 plus b being b, for example. Yeah. So in any given sequence, the token that you're given doesn't actually have any meaning. Implicitly, it's defined by the context. Okay. Well, any other questions about that?
How good is the model of this?
So it's good. It gets 100%. It's perfect at it.
It's always the same,
So no. So right. So we have lots of different groups of different orders. So it's like from size 3 groups up to size 10 groups. So elements with 10 groups, or groups with 10 elements, groups with 3 elements, and anything in between. And there's also cyclic and dihedral groups, which just there's different groups that have different properties. So one like cyclic groups are abelian, so that they commute. So like 1 and 3, 1 plus 3 is the same as 3 plus 1, but dihedral groups, that's not necessarily true. Like 3 plus 1 might be different from 1 plus 3, for example. Yeah, so the models are really good at this kind of thing, which is like pretty cool because none of the symbols mean anything. And so we've been trying to understand like how in the world do these models do this sort of thing when they're trying to reason about symbols that don't mean anything. So one of the mechanisms that we've been looking into that I've been looking into recently, we're calling this like the elimination rule mechanism. So given some like generic query, so the way that I'm talking about this is like there's some A slot and there's some B slot. The symbol might not be A or might not be B. So the hypothesis is that it uses some variable closure, and I'll talk about what that means, along with left and right cosets to kind of solve something like this. So what I mean by closure is, so given some query like 8B, the model first would need to know what are all the things. Oh, I guess I should preface this with, within a sequence, you can also have multiple groups going at the same time. So you might have like three sets of vocabulary assignments where like elements from one group don't ever interact from an element and in another group. So the model sort of has to keep track of what elements belong to the group that I'm currently predicting for, along with this. And so by variable closure, what I mean is like model first needs to figure out what are all the elements that belong to the group that I'm thinking about at the moment. So like for 8B, like what are all the things that I've seen A associated with before, or 8 associated with before, and B associated with before. So that's what variable closure would be. And then left and right cosets. So a coset is basically just all of the things that are like associated with the 8 or the B, for example, separately. So like I've tried to highlight these in colors. So like the left coset for 8B would be all the things in the prompt that are attached to an 8 previous in the context. So like 8 times E, 8 times 7, 8 times 8. And like the way that I'm representing it here as a variable is the value that that coset pair produced. So like 6, E, and B. And the same thing here for the right coset. So B, E, and 8. And the reason, there's a few reasons why we think this might be happening, but like one of them is like at the A slot, for example, when, so we train this model with cross entropy loss. So like when the model is at the 8 and it's trying to predict some new token, like it predicts a perfectly uniform distribution over all of the things that it's seen 8 with associated before. So like it sort of knows what the closure is. And we hypothesize that it might use that as part of its prediction at the equals slot to like filter out possible answers. So, and I guess the second reason is like all of these pairs are invertible. So, like if you see something like 8 times e and the context is 6, then you know that 8 times b can't be 6 because b is not e. So, you might like think about maybe it takes some kind of closure and then takes like the difference between the union of the cosets. So, something like this, you'd get like here's the closure, this is this set, you have the left and right cosets, you take their union. And you just are left with one number in the end that you're is actually the right answer. To kind of verify whether this like C variable exists, we set up some counterfactual pairs of prompts. So like there's these source and base prompts where we construct these C sets, L sets, and R sets such that you get some counterfactual answer that you're supposed to get some kind of counterfactual answer when you patch in what might represent this C set into the base prompt. And the way that we're trying to represent this C set is via some subspace. So what we're doing is learning a mask over PCA activations. And when you do that, like it turns out that you can learn this little 18-dimensional subspace that kind of governs this C variable with 100% validation accuracy. So it seems like it does, the model does represent this C variable. I feel like people are people following? I don't know. Maybe I'm going too quick. We're good.
You know how you prove it? Or what is happening? Is that clear at all?
Couldn't get one of mask over PCA activations.
Okay. So yeah, so what I'm doing is I take activations over a bunch of different prompts. Like at the equals token, and then I just run PCA on that, and that gives me some set of directions that are supposed to determine like the amount of variance in the activation space. And then what I do is I'm learning a mask on top of those directions to find out which ones are important. So the mask is just like a value between 0 and 1 of like how much should I include this direction. When I patch between source and base, because I'm doing like a projection basically from source to base. Does that make sense? Okay. Yeah. So that's pretty cool. And then I think the other thing I'll share is so the subspace that we learned at the equal slot also happens to govern closure at the A slot. So it's kind of cool, like this same little subspace can flip the prediction of like what the model thinks the variables that have been seen or the symbols that have been seen are. So in this is an example. So like in the base prompts, this for this case, like this was the variable assignments, like 607839, and in the source prompt that we're patching the activation from in this subspace, this was the other like variable assignment. So what's different is like A5 and B. So when we patch in this little subspace, what we expect to happen, and it does happen, is like the logits of A, B, and 5 go up, and like the logits of 6, 7, and 9 go down. Whereas like in the original case, for the base case, like you just see like 0, 3, 6, 7, 9, 8, which are all of the base vocabs. So, yeah, anyway, there's still a lot to do, I think, in this project, but I feel like made some good progress in the last couple weeks of like trying to understand this particular mechanism. I think what's been challenging is like seems like there's lots of things happening in parallel, and so trying to like pin down individual ones by like making counterfactuals that are like explicitly targeted to the thing we're looking for. Yeah.
So this is you're looking at the output level, right? Like the prediction of the model
Yeah,
changes.
these are the logics at the end.
And when is it that you do the patching?
So
And then.
I'm doing the intervention on the attention output at layer three, which is there's like so there's only I guess there's four layers in this little model, and so it's at the last layer attention output, but there's an MLP after that before the unembed.
And did you select this attention here in some specific manner, or was just like, let's try with the last one and see?
Like we've spent a lot of time looking at like attention patterns and stuff, and like the first three layers seem like they basically don't do anything except for like accumulate information about like individual facts into themselves. And so like all the information, all the computation's been doing like getting done at the last layer. Yeah, so one of the I guess one thing yeah, I don't know. Lots of things still to do. But
Yeah, what else is there to do?
so like one thing I need to do still, so the model has so like another mechanism beyond like this closure subspace is like how the model solves identity queries. So like if one of the elements in the query is an identity, it seems like this has been causing problems for like trying to figure out other mechanisms. So I've like basically filtered it out of all of my data.
What happens if you don't filter it out?
Oh, that like so then like the subspace that you learn it plateaus around like 80%. So it sort of like messes up your subspace that you're trying to learn. So like I guess like the closure subspace doesn't really govern identity facts. Like there's some other something that's going on there that the model's using to solve those. So that's like one thing I'm hoping to pin down. I sort of have an idea of like generally, so like I think the way that you would solve something like this is like you'd need to know what the identity element is and then just pick the other one that's in the pair, you know. So some kind of like reverse copying sort of thing. And like we've looked at like PCAs of like of hidden states, and it seems like all the identity facts are usually like put to one side from the rest of the facts. So there is like something weird about identity or different about identity facts. Just four.
Kind of an orthogonal direction, but it could be kind of informative to see, I guess, like what the representations look like and how they evolve, like as you give it more and more examples of the task. Because I would sort of be curious to see whether it like learns this sort of very regular arrangement of like the tokens in the vocabulary, such that, you know, the identity is always like, you know, maybe in the center of like all these other numbers, such that nothing happens when it's added to all the others, or something like that. It was sort of like that paper, like in context learning representations, where you could sort of just like analyze qualitatively, like you know, I guess what the structure looks like, and if it seems to be like mapping to something kind of like closure operations.
So we that was like one of the inspirations for why we started doing this kind of thing, and like we started out with that, and like we were hoping to see some like nice little like circles or something for like cyclic groups, for example. Like in other work, people have shown like when you learn cyclic groups, the model sort of like learns how to embed stuff in like nice circles. But like we don't see that here. But we do see that the identity is like off on its own, and basically everything else is just like clustered together. But it might be like if you had like I guess like within this little subspace or something like. You might see better separation or something.
Yeah, we were very disappointed that there were no circles. I kept on telling Eric, you gotta look harder. There's gotta be circles somewhere. And you know, The conclusion is that there's something about the setting where Mono is solving it in a different way. And
Is that where the closure hypothesis came from?
where did the closure hypothesis come from?
That came from me thinking about at the A slot, the model basically knows what are the elements that are involved. And then I was reading this book about abstract algebra, and they were talking about like the cancellation law, and I had already I guess I spent a lot of time looking at failure cases of the model when you give it too short of prompts or something like that, of not enough context to actually solve anything, and so that helped me sort of build out a bigger list of hypotheses. But then thinking about this A slot closure, uniformly predicts all of the elements in the set, which is pretty impressive. And then maybe it's kind of using that as a filter for what answers. So originally I was like, oh, maybe it's just using that as a filter for what answers it could predict. Because it never predicts an answer that doesn't show up in the context.
Interesting. So I guess you wouldn't even necessarily need a representation of the modulo operation to be able to do that. Yeah. If you go look directly for representations of some kind of modulo operation.
Yannick was looking at some stuff for that. I don't think we really ever
For what?
found.
What was the question?
The model actually knowing how to do a modulo operation.
Right. Aren't you training models that are going to try to evoke the circles? I'm not sure.
That's the plan. Yeah.
So what's the hypothesis?
So I think the idea is when all of your symbols are concrete, that's when you would see these modular circles. But when your symbols are variable, then I guess the interesting case is the mix between when sometimes your symbols are concrete and sometimes they're variable. Who knows which of these kinds of two algorithms you'll learn. Yeah.
Okay, we got one to Jaden. Thank you, Bert. Thank you, Eric. Yeah, okay, Jaden. Okay, and thank you, Arnold.
Okay, today I'm giving an update on what's going on with MCED and NDIF. Lots changing in the next year. Good. Change.
Who here uses MCED?
Okay, all right. Yes. So, like usual, I have totally rewritten all of Insight because there were some fundamental things about how it previously worked that just kind of wasn't sufficient for a lot of different use cases. For those of you working with paper and
We take your code and we convert it into an intervention graph, a computation graph with a bunch of different nodes that represent the things you want to do during the model's forward pass. But to do this, we have to manually support any type of intervention that you'd want to do, say like a print statement or a breakpoint, because when say you do print a proxy object, maybe this is getting too much in the weeds. Python doesn't know how to deal with a proxy object with print, so we have to manually say insight.log or insight.list. So this paradigm makes it so we have to manually support literally every single thing that you'd ever want to do. So instead, we're just doing what you would kind of the simple solution that I thought of, you know, when I first started doing this, was just take the user's code, compile it into some function, and then execute it at the appropriate time during the forward pass. As I'll talk a little about later, the reason why I didn't do that is because the whole point of this project is NDIF, and you know, executing arbitrary code is pretty dangerous on the server. But now that I know more about how Python works, I feel like I can protect sufficiently against it. So yeah, and this is a just-in-time compilation. So what happens is when you hit a with block, no matter where you are in your code execution, at that moment, we then you take a look at your current like Python stack, extract the code, and then take your code and put it inside a function to run later on, which I'll show a little bit of a visualization in a second. Yeah, so just here's a code snippet, and this is the one I used a while ago, where we're just setting some neuron activations to be 10 and getting the output. And in the old world, this code in your you know, Python script would be executing, even though the model hasn't executed yet, to create this intervention graph by saying, okay, you want the input of this module, I'm gonna create a node for that in my graph. I'm gonna index it at 0, create another node. I'm gonna, you know, set it to 10, create another node. And then once you've exited the trace context, we actually take the computation graph and do the interventions with your module's forward pass. And so now, instead, we're just, you know, taking your code, extracting it, and then putting it inside a function. And then so now we can just grab this function later on and then appropriately interleave it with the module's forward pass at the right time.
Questions?
Yeah.
Questions?
Yeah.
So, how will the implementation change in the user side? Change it all?
I'll talk about there's like one change that you need. Well, actually, there's two changes. Backwards pass syntax is changing, and then again, I'll talk about it in another slide. Is the execution order of the model is enforced with your interventions now, which is actually fundamental to like how this works. Like you couldn't do it any other way, but people were asking for that anyway. Like it should be the interventions you define should match the order of execution of the model. So if you're not doing backwards passes, you never have to worry about any changes. And if you're already doing your interventions in the order of execution of the model, which probably most people are, you wouldn't have to change anything either.
What happens to variable state that was set up outside the with?
So let's say you had like a tensor called X above the with block
Yeah,
and
or
you
an
reference
integer,
it.
right? You have to say, my string equals hello world.
Yep. So when we take your code and we compile it into a Python function, it we take the current frames, globals and locals, and it is aware of all those. So then when you actually define it, Python knows how to like make those like co-variables inside the function to reference later on.
Oh, I see. What if one of them is so one of them could be some weird class, right? One of them could be like oh, I just I keep all my data sets in some SQL database and some custom data structure, and I
Right.
called some weird function to construct the thing, and now that's in my local variable X, right? And
You're
then
saying for the
I
remote case it is
And yeah, and then I go into
yeah.
the yeah, and then I go into the with block, and then of course I'm going to use this data set thing I just loaded, and I'll use X all over the place.
Right. So there's still a conception of whitelisting certain libraries, but it's actually much simpler now in the sense that in the old case, not only would you have to whitelist, say, your SQL library, but you'd also have to make like a custom entry into the custom serialization format that we were doing before, right? Say,
Right.
okay, here's how you serialize your SQL
We would have had to do
class.
that.
You had to do that before, but now we're just, you know, using dill, which is pickling essentially, and then making
Oh, because
sure
SQL is
only,
because it's pickleable,
right.
then I have access.
And we've whitelisted whatever module that it's involved in. So like, you know, if you use pandas, we have to whitelist pandas, torch, torch, and we can make sure only subsets of the modules are allowed
I
as
see.
well.
But if it doesn't follow those rules, then I just get some sort of error.
Yeah, I mean, anything is pickleable,
No, it's
essentially
true.
in Python, but yeah.
Oh, I see.
Yeah.
Yeah. But I mean, if it's not on the whitelist or
Yes, if it's
whatever,
on the
then I
whitelist,
guess
it'll
it's
say like
fine.
this is not whitelisted. Yeah.
Anyway, that's my question. Any other questions?
Yeah. Like a common case with that was I think there's like a stopping criteria object that people would use in the generation. And before we'd have to like make I'd have to like make an entry stopping criteria. Here's how you serialize it. But now pickle will just pickle it up. We'll allow anything under the torch wherever it's, you know, defined, and then it should be able to be sent remotely. Cool. Okay, so now to like actual features. So, this allows us to now put anything in the forward pass. So, like, when you're doing insight locally, now this is like 1,000 times better, right? You don't have to worry about any weird, proxy errors. If you want to print something out, you don't have to worry about putting, an insight.log here. Here, I'm just printing things out. I'm actually putting a breakpoint here, and I'm able to just, stop on the debugger. I'm able to see what L3, L2, L1 is at this point in the debugger. I could even, change the variables and do in-place operations, and then allow it to go on. So I could, put a breakpoint, do my interventions manually, and then have the model continue on, which is great for actually like doing your developing your experiments. Yeah, Koyana.
So before, in order to get inputs, we needed to have the entire model in our local. I think I forget there was a flag that we needed to add in to just load up the whole model. Do you
Yes. Same thing. So you mean dispatch?
yes,
Yeah,
dispatch.
So, the default behavior is when you load up an insight model, right? It's going to assume that you're not actually, loading the actual parameters until you exit the with block.
But
Because the default use case is using it remotely, so people will. Yeah.
we don't in this particular case right now, do we still need to do dispatch equals true, or this time around it's possible to do it without?
Yeah, so it's the same behavior as before, where if you didn't do dispatch as true, it would dispatch it automatically the first time you executed something locally. And another great thing is before, yeah, go ahead.
So if I am not dispatching, if I'm
Yes.
executing this code remotely,
Mm-hmm.
then do I still see the print statement throughout the
Yes,
entire process?
absolutely. I can just really quickly.
What demo?
Yeah, I have an example here where I just, print starting intervention and then printing intervention complete. And then don't worry about some of this other stuff here. But if I run this, I have a local version of NDIF running on one of the VLAB machines, which works with 0.5. And it'll be returned to you as a like an insight log,
Okay, nice.
entry. So now, like, let's say you wanted to do like a TDQM to like see your process as you're generating something, you'd be able to see that updated automatically with anything that's outputted to SCD out.
Awesome. And what happens to that breakpoint line?
So the breakpoints don't work remotely yet, but that isn't the next thing I want to do. Which wouldn't be too hard. You would just have to like use the take the user's input back and forth and show the outputs and interact with things. One of the a common pain point before of using Insight was the error messages, and Adam did some stuff to address that. But now, when you hit an error message anywhere in your intervention code, we kind of recreate the exception as if it were just locally running on your machine, not extracted and ran later. So if you just see here, I have some variable y which isn't defined, and other than just this like wrap exception part, which I can't really remove. This trace back is exactly what you'd see if you ran this normally in your collab notebook. You'd see here's the line, L3 plus Y, here's the actual line and cell it's at, and then here's the error message. And that works in a variety of different cases where, let's say, you have an error in a separate file or in a function somewhere else, it'll point you to the right spot. And then, when I use VS Code, I can control click on it to actually go to the line and see where the error was. Go ahead.
Can somebody just set up a a log file and just write to it whenever an error pops up or some type of a print statement instead of doing this, or is that not possible?
You're saying consensus remotely, or you're saying just anytime you're using Insight, even locally?
Anytime.
Yeah, I mean, you can just already do this in Python, right? Where you just redirect any SCD out to some log function, and you could do that here as well. But Insight isn't like allowing or preventing you from doing that in any capacity. So, like I already said, Insight will now enforce execution order, which is just honestly a good thing in general to reduce the confusion of people using Insight, because sometimes people, I think, is Natalie on here? Yeah. She had, I think, an issue she submitted where she specifically wanted, if things were out of order, to give you an error. Because, let's say, in the old Insight, if I were to set the output of layer 0 to something, I would have interacted with it here. Well, it would have been after layer one, so it would have really had no effect on the actual model's output, and it would have been a silent failure. Here, this is what the error looks like right now. Maybe I'll change what it says in the future, but it'll say value was missed for, this output. Did you call an envoy out of order? I'd like to maybe also show you like what the last module that was called was, to like maybe give you exactly where in your code this happened. But I think it's a good start in telling you what's going on. So like I said before, besides the module ordering, the main syntax that's changing is the backwards pass syntax. In 0.4, I had to do a bunch of really weird stuff in order to like interleave your backwards pass interventions with your forward pass interventions. So before, you would just interact with the dot grad attribute on any like tensor proxy object, and then calling dot backwards would eventually hook it in the right spot, and inset would handle doing the interventions. But now, just like the forward pass is a with context where you set some interventions and then inset handles actually executing them for you, the backwards pass is now also a with block. So in on the right-hand side in 0.5, I do my normal forward pass intervention on the top with that outputs, and then I do a backwards pass on the LM head outputs, and I interact with the dot grad attribute of the tensor variable I saved previously. So nothing from no dot outputs or inputs should happen inside the backwards, and then no dot grad interaction should happen outside the dot backwards. And just like the module execution order is enforced with the forward pass, you should interact with dot grad attributes in the reverse order they were defined, right? Because the backwards pass obviously starting from the end.
If I'm like trading something, I don't really care about grads. I just want to call down backward. Do I have to use a with?
No, you can just do backward. Yep. Oh yeah. Before, I had that like trace equals false if you wanted to like use there's like a function like dot trace something. I don't need that anymore. It'll just like say like this is out of date, deprecated now. Because I can like, because I'm looking at your code anyway, I can tell if it's a with block or not. And I can just decide whether or not to execute it or convert it into a with block. Yeah.
In this case, let's say I just want to see the gradient update at every data point. So like it's not that it's going to be sequential, it's like it's different separate ones. Like does me doing like model.trace like kind of restart the model at its like initial stage, or like do I have to, I don't know, create like a new one? Like is the dot backward thing affecting like feature runs, I guess. Is there a way to,
Affected in what way?
so like let's say I'm doing like a backward pass on like hello world, and then
Yeah.
there's another one like bye world or something, but I don't want it to be like together. I want it to be like two separate, like original to like fine-tuning like this particular data point. Can I do that?
I mean, so the behavior is if like you ran it without insight, right? So if you did a forward pass and you did some backwards and you did a forward pass again, that would be the same behavior here. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, correct. Yeah.
Yes. So this backwards context is within this trace, so it's only interacting with the gradients collected during this forward pass. So like if you did a backwards pass after this trace and another trace, it wouldn't be tied to that forward pass. It'd be tied to the new one that you're doing. So there's also this new feature, module skipping. Some people on the GitHub. So in the previous insight, there was module.stop, right? If you wanted to stop the execution of the model early, you could do that. So let's say you wanted to only get the activations layer one. Well, you could do after that layer one.stop. Some people might also want to just start the model from a certain point, say like start it at layer two because they already have previous layer two activation stored, and then run the model to the end. That's hard because in the model's actual code, right, there's loops and all this stuff where like you have to save the state essentially. So just literally starting at some point in the model is pretty tricky. This is kind of the next best thing where let's say I had the activations for layer one that I wanted to start at. Well, I could call dot skip on layer zero, which would just not execute that module at all. And how the actual behavior works is by default, dot skip will take the first input and then give that as the output. So it kind of just assumes whatever the input shape was as the output. But for a lot of cases, that isn't true. So you would just give dot skip as a variable something that you want to use as the output. Let's say I want to just give like a blank tensor or something. Because like obviously the code in the actual transformer forward pass needs a tensor, right, of some shape to not give you an error. But this will skip over the actual execution of the module, which is the slow piece here.
Sorry, if you're just skipping, you can just output a zero tensor, right? That will be equivalent to skipping.
Yes, exactly. Well, no, you're saying if you did before did output equals tensor zeros? Is that what you're saying?
Yeah.
Well, no, because that before that would actually execute the module, but then essentially be meaningless as you outputted your tensor.
Yeah, but right now, I'm not really clear what you are doing. Probably we don't really care. Well, we
Yeah.
don't, we client, at the client side, not, don't really need to know
Yeah, I mean,
much,
I'll
but
just quickly tell you, like,
yeah.
so we're not using torch hooks anymore. We're using our own hooks, so
Okay.
which allows us to like completely define the behavior of when you call a module. So when we see the skip flag essentially set, we just don't execute the module at all, and we just pass your thing to the output.
Past the just basically propagate the input of what is supposed to be the input of H0 to H1 directly.
Yeah, so dot H0 dot input here
Yeah.
would be the same as dot H0 output. It'd be just outputting the input. Or you can define, like I said, whatever you want with the output instead.
You can only do that when the input output shapes match exactly.
Right. So like that's why usually you'll probably give a value here to dot skip. You'll have to know what the shape is and you give it here. But this is the default behavior is pass the input to the output. So like, you know, the MLP, right, or the attention, that's often the case for just like the shape is the same. I think it might be right to not have that DB default behavior and force you to specify it so there's no confusion. I don't know if you guys have thoughts on that.
Plenty of submodules where the shape is just not the same.
Yeah.
Different pieces of MLPs.
Right. Okay, so the coolest feature for sure is interacting with intra forward pass intermediate values. So before, when Insight used torch hooks, the only thing we could access were the inputs and outputs of modules, which for probably about 85% of cases was fine, but for the 15% of cases that isn't, you really couldn't do your interventions, or you kind of have to recompute them manually. So like the most common use case, and you know, Aaron and Nikhil could attest to this, is getting the actual attention outputs before softmax. Is usually that's not revealed as a module input or output. That's just some operation, you know, before softmax. So how we do that now in 0.5 is in addition to that input and that output on your modules, you can now interact with this dot source attribute. And so when I print out dot source on a given module, what I'll see is I'll see in my console a representation of the forward pass with names associated with each operation that happens within it. So for example, in this one, I printed out the attention of GPT-2 on the first layer. And on the, let's say I wanted to get the output of the split operation on line 21 after the C attention. Well, I can now get that by directly interacting with this self underscore Q underscore attention zero variable off of dot source. And so what that looks like in terms of syntax is,
Wait, which line number? There's too much code.
is line 21.
Line 21. Self dot C attention. You pass in encoder hidden states. What goes to the C attention module?
Yeah, or so let's say I wanted to get the output of the split, right? Because I didn't want to split it myself. This is not a great use case, but I'll show you a better one in the next few
Okay.
slides.
Yeah,
Then I
I
can interact
expect
with
it.
split underscore zero instead. But here, if I wanted to interact with the attention interface zero, which is the actual how the most transformer architectures work, is it passes a
Is this the
function.
same ex example?
Yes, it's the same example. I
So
don't know, think you can.
it's called attention interface zero.
Yeah, I think it's lower on this list here, but I can show it in my notebook if you want.
Oh, I see. It's not on the screen.
Yeah.
Okay, I was confused because I'm like, how do you know that?
Yeah, here, I'll just quickly. I think I already have it in here. Yep. So yeah, here's the forward passive attention. And how most of these architectures work is it actually has some other function where it actually computes the attention given the query keys and values, and the output is the post softmax values. So even in this case where I've accessed the source of the attention, I still actually can't access the variable that I want to access, which is the pre softmax attention. So this dot source functionality works recursively. So here's the actual the output of the attention interface, which again isn't what I want. This will still give me the post softmax values. I can then interact with the dot source attribute of this attention interface zero to now see, okay, now what is the source of this function? And that will give me, here's the actual, SPQDA attention forward pass, which then I can access, say, like attention output transpose or torch NN functional scale dot product attention. The actual real case here is if I gave it the eager mode to do, which is what I the examples that I've given to Aaron and others, because that's where you can actually get the pre-softmax values, because here Torch computes all of this in one kernel for the attention output, but you can still access it.
And also probably intervention value.
Absolutely. It's just as if it was any other variable that you'd have in the inputs or outputs.
This is great.
Before I go on, like, I don't know, any quick feedback on how this looks in terms of what would be maybe more helpful in deciding where you want to intervene? I mean, really, all I can just say is, like, here's the code, right? And I don't know if I can do any like processing further than that to say, here's what this actually represents. Here's the real attention.
So this still interacts with like skip. Like you could like skip one of these modules and
Yep.
stuff like that, right? So like if you were stuck because PyTorch has some unified kernel where it doesn't break apart the thing you need, you could skip that thing and you
Recompute
could
it
implement it
yourself.
yourself
Yeah.
and then put the answer in that you need.
Absolutely.
Is that right? So that's still pretty flexible.
Yeah, I agree. It's like as flexible as you can possibly be. It's just for like maybe users who aren't familiar with going into the
I
transform the
see.
lens
I'm just
code.
asking. Yeah.
Yeah.
Is this the actual code from Hugging Face, or is this some pretty printed version of the bytecodes or something
This
like
is
that?
the actual code from Hugging Face, other than I've added line numbers and arrows pointing to the given.
I see. So this is like Hugging Face comments and stuff like that.
Yes.
And the line numbers are a little different because they're your line numbers.
Yeah, I mean, I can't just directly access the numbers like in a text. I would have to do it myself. So I am doing it myself here.
One thing is like there's a ton of ifs here, and so like a lot of these variables
Might be dead.
won't actually exist.
Yeah.
And so like you'll have to really know like what's in your config, I guess, to know like, oh, which of these, like, I guess, do you have like a way to know like, oh, this one's dead?
So what will happen is, let's say I wanted to access the is causal item at line 33, which is in an if statement. What would happen if that actually didn't, the if statement wasn't true, is after your model's executing, it'll say, hey, I'm still waiting for a value. This is probably an error. And it'll say, I was still waiting for this thing. Did you call something out of order, or was something not called?
So that's right. That's a nice thing. So you find the error message, but it's a reasonable question, right? It's like, I wonder if there's some clever way of you asking for the source, maybe even after it's executed, since you're in the with block anyway, and then or asking for the source in some way that the printout is deferred so that you can highlight the variables that actually ended up existing in the source. You can be like, huh. These blue ones are the ones that actually were live in this pass.
Okay, you're saying people could do like a test run or a run before, and then I would know which ones happened or
The
not.
funny thing is you're inside this with anyway. Like to even get the source, you're like doing a run, right? Aren't you?
Right, for sure. That's what I'm saying. Like any previous run, I could have already be caching this stuff. But like if, in the very first time they invoke this, they wanted to interact with this variable and then also know if it was alive or not, right? By the time it's, I know what it is, it's,
Like
yeah.
when you run your experiment, you're not going to be like saying that's worse, right? This is like a developer tool, right? Like to
No,
know if that's
people
worse.
in their experiment will like in the code that every MIB and Michael Hanna, they'll like if they want to interact with the attention and like do interventions on it, this is how they would interact with the attention.
Okay, so I'm confused.
Yeah.
So like you would say blah 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 dot, you print blah 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 dot source. And you need to do that in order to get access to, torch under, is underscore causal atom underscore zero.
Right.
Like if you don't say dot source, then that other variable doesn't exist.
Exactly. If you don't they say that source, you can't access it because that's how Insight's providing access to it. Otherwise, you're stuck with the inputs and outputs of modules.
Oh, okay. Because I my what I had imagined was you print out dot source to find out the secret variable name.
Both. So
And
you print it out,
then
just be
after
it.
that, you could use that variable name without saying that source again. But maybe I missed the syntax. What is it?
So yeah, you can print it out to see this, but then you also take these variables off of the dot source attribute to actually
Oh,
interact
right.
with them.
That source dot this.
Yes.
So like the full chain to grab like attention output here. Do you have something?
Yes. So the full chain would be something like this. I would go to the module dot source, the variable that I want, which is a function, and then dot source, and then after this, it would be dot whatever other variable name dot save if I wanted to access that
So
variable.
it'd be like dot torch and end attention output.
Yes.
Dot save.
Yes. I think I have the actual.
So if you said something like, instead of just saying printing dot source, if you had something like print dot source dot code, then dot code could have the semantics of, oh, it's actually collects the code after the whole thing has been run so that you can color the things that actually were variables that were used in blue or something, right?
And so, like, code wouldn't exist until you've ran it one time. Is that what
Yeah,
you're saying? Yeah.
something like that. Like, 'cause people don't care when the code is run when they're just looking at the actual code, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. And then that code can be, so I
It's a
agree
good
with you.
idea.
Like it's like you see this complex code and a lot of it is dead, right? In a typical run. And that could make it a lot easier to navigate.
That's a good idea.
Right, like what they really care about is like attention output. But you have to know whether using eager is true and self.reorder.upcast attention is true. And if not, then I have to grab a different.
Right. It depends on what all those booleans are.
Which, like, you can figure it out, but people won't want to.
Yeah, it'll take a long time, trial and error.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think that's a good idea. And then just a quick end if update.
So
Yeah.
that's really neat. I actually haven't you haven't seen that I haven't seen that feature before. It's really cool. Is that gonna interact with, so you've had this long-standing thing of like making attention easier, more uniform between stuff like this, sort of uniform naming.
Yeah.
So have you been thinking about like how the uniform naming idea will like interact with this dot source stuff?
Yeah, exactly. So you could do renaming, like instead of people having to access this like long thing, I could just say whatever you want to call this, like the real attention or something. You could just do like dot attention dot real attention. And I would have remapped that path to just be okay, dot source, dot whatever, dot
I see.
whatever.
So you think so remap would interact with this
Yes.
nicely.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I don't talk about it here, but one of the other probably the biggest like pain point I don't really address is in Transformer Lens, right? They totally recreate all the models based on their architectures so that they're all consistent across architectures. And that's probably a little too intensive for us. So, but what we can do is we can at least have a common set of like renamings. So if you want to interact with, say, you know, the output of attention, it's always called blah 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 dot attention, which will work in a lot of cases, but obviously some models are so weird, right, where that doesn't even make sense to begin with.
Of the modern models that are used consistently in
Yeah.
JavaScript. So you care about that. Most of the modern models, they have the same like naming structure.
Well, I know the llama. Like I mostly interact with llamas these days. It's like mostly dot model dot whatever. But I don't know. Do the other ones also do model dot layers? They all do dot model dot layers essentially. Yeah.
Like sometimes they're different. The norm name is a little bit different, but it's still the module name is not, maybe not.
Like sometimes they have like outfrage or outfrage. You
Oh.
there's like slight differences, which is just yeah.
It's annoying. I see. So yes for mapping or no for mapping?
I think mapping too. If you, I mean, if you want it, you can, like as an example.
Yeah, I
But I
think
think we
mapping for
all,
sure.
most of us end up building mapping on top.
Oh, you build a mapping thing?
Yeah.
What, using GetAdder or something?
No, I just like build some like dictionaries of like module, common module names and then.
And then use bracket.
Yeah. Well, one thing that exists in 0.4 that I'll re-emphasize in 0.5 is you can pass this dictionary of rename to any language model or Envoy, and that will just like rename anything, you know, with this name to some other name, so that I could like access it with either of them.
I see. So they so that already
That
exists.
already exists.
And so the only thing that we're really missing is like somebody to create standard renames for everything.
Yeah.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Interesting.
And so just a quick end of update. If you guys are interested, I can talk more about any of these things. So we've moved all of our non-compute services to AWS. So that's like everything that isn't on Delta and isn't executing the actual model. That saves a lot of headache for us because AWS comes with a lot of these services, like backups, like telemetry. And then it also moves away from this, you know, MGPCC cluster that we were on, which isn't super reliable in some ways and means if one thing goes down, everything goes down. We've decided to move our entire backend service to Delta from Delta AI. So the difference is Delta AI is this new cluster they had, and which was billed to us as, you know, the way to run AI models in the future. But, and I can talk more about this, there's this kind of this critical problem with this architecture because it's very new architecture. And it comes with all these problems which prevent us from doing more interesting features with NDIF. So now we're moving back to Delta, which has a bunch of A40s and some H200s. And that will allow us to do so many more cool things. And also runs faster. I don't know. That's what Michael's experience has been so far. Yeah. Yeah, the load times on Delta now are like, it was like an hour for 4 or 5 before. It's like 15 minutes now.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah.
What the heck?
Yeah.
NVIDIA really screwed up with the grayscale
Yeah.
stuff.
Well, again, we also had to like again copy all of the shards from the thing to the node and then
Yeah,
back.
yeah.
But yeah. Hopefully in like 6 months they
I
have
haven't
had
been
this
following.
patch.
Does the 16-bit 4 or 5 B fit in
Yes,
one node?
it fits
One
on one
node.
node, yeah. I think it has like 30 gigabytes
Oh,
left
just
over.
squeeze in.
I don't know if that's enough. We'll have to do some, I guess, testing. Yeah.
All right. That's great. That's great.
I have a question for you guys. Do you guys have any sense of when you run just your general experiments, like what percentage of the GPU is being used by the activations versus the model? Like, is it like the model's like 85% and the activations are 15? I'm looking for just like some heuristic where I can say like, okay, make sure this percentage is reserved for activations on any given GPU.
That says it.
Yeah.
Sometimes we our batch sizes are pretty small,
Yeah.
less than four, but
Less than
still,
four.
I mean, for
Right.
the batching experiments at least.
I
So
see. Yeah, source-based and intervention, like three.
Right.
Interesting.
And that's why I was talking to Delta, right? They were like, oh, the Grasshoppers are so much faster than A100s. What are you talking about? And it seems like that is true for batch size greater than like 20. You know, but for anything under 20, the A100s and A40s are still faster. So, yep. So before NEMI, we have to have a lot of this
What
done.
do you think?
Well, I mean, I'm playing with tiny models and my batch size is like 1,000, so I don't
Yeah. But for like, and you know, you use 70B sometimes. Like anything you've done with 70B is probably.
like 50. Batch size of 50 would usually fit.
Okay. I should see what percentage batch size 50 is of level 70B.
Interesting. So when the user code comes along, are you able to look at it before you start running on the GPU and estimate like what its batch sizes are going to be or how much memory it's going to take or
Yeah, we could do that.
yeah.
Before we execute, we can know we have the batch size. We could look at
Oh
it
yeah.
and then again have some, at least with language models, right, have some easy heuristic of what it'll take.
Cool.
So before NEMI, we want to have a lot of this done. So 0.5 definitely will be released by NEMI. We're going to have our own queuing service, and not to get too much in the weeds here, but how one of our dependencies, Ray, is set up, we can't really get the queue size, which would be really valuable for users, right, to see where they are in the queue. Surprisingly, that's difficult with what we have now. So we're going to make our own queuing service. The big NDIF feature set coming in year two is involved around having a huge list of models that are available. And so they might not all be loaded into GPU memory, right? But they'll be available to be loaded where you will have different tiers, right? Where like the hottest tier will be it's in the GPU ready to serve. Warm will be it's in the CPU memory ready to be swapped in, which is pretty fast. And then cold will be it's on, you know, the hard drive needs to be loaded in. And so you'll ask for a model that isn't available yet, and this will just happen automatically. So, you know, our available models will go from like 7 to like, you know, 400 overnight once we have this. And that's probably like the big feature that we're going to be working on the next few months. And on top of all this, I don't know if you guys know, but you know, one of our main offerings that we're having with NDIF is that, you know, we have Insight, which allows you to interact with models, then NDIF, a backend to actually do this on large models. And then on top of all this, we want to have all these interfaces for you to do, you know, preliminary interp research that use NDIF and Insight as a backend. So, you know, in the classroom as preliminary experiments, so you can understand some behavior and then, you know, maybe go on your own, then do the real experiments. And so by NEMI, Caden is working on a logit lens version of this, and this is kind of our first UI offering for NDIF. And then I just have a little like this is the screenshot he has right now. You know, you'll be able to select all of our like NDIF models as a drop down, have little workspaces where you have like your previous experiments, run different prompts, see the, you know, the logits of the different probabilities via logit lens. Yeah. And you know, we see this obviously being much more useful in the future when we have more techniques, like doing like circuit discovery would probably be one of the coolest ones in this benchmark. Yeah. Did you guys see the Anthropic UI thing for the circuit fizz? That's cool. Yeah, I was thinking like something like that for NDIF would be like an end goal for me for the UIs.
Yeah, it's cool.
You know, something like Nikhil's doing, like use that here. Yeah, somehow automate that. Okay.
All right. Any other questions for Jaden? Thanks a lot, Jaden.
Thank you.
Hey.